You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
The 3CR Gardening Show is coming to you today from the Woi Wurrung Nation. We acknowledge the Wurundjeri people as the traditional owners of this land. We recognise the practices of care and cultivation of the land and waters by the First Peoples and pay our respects to their elders past and present. Wherever you are and wherever you garden, we encourage you to know whose land you're on.
Well, good morning, everybody. I think we've actually got through. I'm sorry about that. This is the 3CR Garden Show. I'm Virginia Haywood, and we had a little bit of a problem coming through to you, but now we are through. This morning in the studio, I've got Ben Brooker from Treasured Perennials, Craig Castry, horticulturist, author, and regenerative edible gardener, and we've got Stephen Wells here, horticultural therapist and nurse who has created extraordinary gardens at one of our hospitals. The reason Stephen is here is to learn how to panel. And as you know from how slowly we started this morning, we started off with problems, but hopefully they will now go. Anyway, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
I have to say, when I came in, there were a few bits of rain and I got terribly excited.
Yes, well, I mean, I can certainly do with a lot of rain where I am.
Oh, Craig, yes, because you're west, you're over Werribee.
Yeah, look, we seem to be, for some reason, in the rain shadow of the Yuyangs.
Yes.
And even though it's not much of a mountain, it really just looks like three small hills, but it seems to split the weather from the west, and it hugs the coast down Werribee Southway, and of course, which is where the market gardeners are. And when you travel over the freeway, and I only live 5 kilometres from Werribee South, they get about 150 millimetres more rainfall than I get. We get rain down there at the orchard, and on the way home, I think, happy days, I'm not going to have to water when I get home, and sure as eggs, I don't get a drop, and it's just been so dry. I'm watering twice a day at the moment. It's ridiculous.
And you, Ben, are you needing rain?
Yeah, I'm definitely needing rain, yeah. But we've been just mulching, so yeah. So whatever, when we start do getting rain, then we can start getting that water capturing into our soil. So, yeah.
And of course, you're dealing with balcony gardens now. You've moved into the cities.
Hey, look, I'm happy for rain anytime. So that sounds great. Yeah, similarly, I was walking out on the footpath this morning and was like, I'm bald. So I did feel that on my forehead and went, oh, that's. Rain, it's coming. I've been watching it. So, yes, it's lovely to know that it's coming.
Yes, I'm a bit like you. I've been at my place for more than 20 years and I never thought of it as somewhere that had a problem for rain. Mm. But now I seem to have developed a rain shadow. Yeah. I watch it coming, particularly if it comes from the east and it moves.
Yeah, look, it certainly has changed. I mean, when I cast my mind back into the mid-70s, late 70s, we used to get incremental rain, none of this sporadic stuff that, you seem to get all the rain all at once and you go months without, and yes. It seems very strange.
And the other thing is we're getting very heavy falls more often.
Yeah, and look, I mean, I guess, as Ben and I both know, that this is largely related to what we've managed to do to soil over the last sort of 100-odd years. We've rapidly accelerated the loss of the water holding capacity of the soil, all the carbon. Mm. We've been liberating that for many, many years and putting it up into the atmosphere, and we've lost the humus in the soil. And that's largely part and partially why we're getting these sporadic rainfall events.
Well, something like 80% of all water in the soil goes through trees.
Yes.
So get rid of your trees, you clearly are going to have a problem.
Yeah. And the other thing too is that, leaving soil bare is a very bad thing to do, because plants and trees emit a microscopic bacterial called an aerosol, and that accounts for about 40% of our rainfall. So if you take the photosynthesis out of the ground, you lose those bacterial aerosols, which form the nucleus upon which water vapour forms, and that's where we get cloud formation.
Hence course, the need for mulch.
Well, it's not so much the whether mulch, it's living, get the plants back in there.
Yeah, that's living the mulch or...
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. I mean, soil should never, ever be uncovered. We should take the term fallow out of our vocabulary. It should never happen. And we, you know, look, we learnt traditionally different methods, but of course things change and of course research gets done and we realise that some of those things were really poor advice.
Well, we used to always double dig our vegetable gardens.
Absolutely, absolutely. It just goes without saying. And of course the thing is that carbon's quite a heavy molecule and of course you open it up to oxygen and two oxygen molecules attached to it. Now you've got CO2 and up it goes. Mm. And with that, you lose the water holding capacity of the soil. So just that it makes common sense not to do that, you know. And, of course, one of the big questions I ask myself these days is how would that happen in nature? And nothing turns soil over like a human. Mm. In nature, nothing but nothing turns that over. Maybe pigs might sort of pig root through, but they don't turn great big acreages or hectare upon hectare of soil over, removing all of the plants and so forth and doing what we do. You know, it's had a negative effect.
Mm. Well, I've taken against Margaret Arnold. I have a salvia in my garden called Margaret Arnold and she is going. She's been there for a very long time and she's very big. And it's very interesting. It goes back to what Ben was saying. As I've taken her out, so she's big enough that I have to prune her before I can dig her out. So I prune her down and the soil all around her, it's not that she's taken more goodness out of the soil than any other plant, but she's covered it so thoroughly that the rain hasn't been getting through because the valley is really green, but you look at the river, the billabong that I walk past in near Woorialik, it's the lowest I've seen it since the drought, and my own dam is so low. It looks terrible. You've seen it, Ben, haven't you? It's really low. And when I'm taking out Margaret Arnold, the soil, because she's just covered it, but it hasn't been mulched because she doesn't really lose her leaves. It's not good.
No.
I'm going to have to throw a green crop on it, green manure on it, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's, yeah. I mean, but I would resist turning that into the soil. I would cut it off below the soil level, particularly if you're going to use nitrogen fixes, something like broad beans or so forth, or lupins or whatever you're going to use, and leave those roots in the ground because that adds wonderful organic matter.
Well, I went yesterday. I have another Ben in my life aside from this Ben. He lives in the Wandon, in the Yarra Valley, and I get my seedlings from him. And I went over yesterday, and he has got the most extraordinary number of figs. He's of Italian heritage, and he's still got figs that his grandfather was growing. And he's got all these, they've all got Italian names, some of them have got Spanish names there. And we walked his figs yesterday. It was so delicious. And he's got striped ones, which I thought were really exciting. But he was saying, there was quite a big weed and under the figs. And I said, oh, well, I pull this out. And he said, oh, no. He said, I don't even take out the grass now. I find with the figs, if I pull out the grass, it disturbs their roots and I just go through and cut everything back to ground level, but I don't take the roots out even of the kaikuyu.
Mm. Yeah, look, I mean, that's probably good advice, to be honest. I mean,
and he does the same with his grapes.
Yeah.
What do you think of that, Ben?
Well, it's the biology as well. I mean, that's a huge part of it. I mean, when you just cut and drop, you're actually leaving the root system there, which has actually got like this biology that's, you know, has this symbolic relationship with the plant and the microbes and the fungi. So that's what's actually solubilizing all those nutrients for these particular plants and capturing carbon and solubilizing nitrogen out of our atmosphere. And so, you know, when you actually pull these plants out, you're actually disturbing that biology. So then you're actually killing off those microscopic sort of bacteria that's sort of solubilizing certain nutrients is one of the essential sort of nutrient or element that's going to produce like a certain amino acid, which is an essential amino acid.
It's kind of like us. I mean, if someone up pulls the internet out on us, we're in trouble. Mm. And it's no different below the soil. It's like the internet of the soil.
Yeah.
And if you unplug it, things collapse, you know, particularly, you know, the fungal network that you can't see. These are microscopic life forms that, you know, they're 1/60th the width of a root hair. It's no surprise we don't see them. I'm sure you might see a bit of mycelium thread, but that could be 10 or 15,000 single fine filament threads called hyphae all matter together, and these are some of the largest organisms on the planet. So, of course, when you pull that out and shake all the soil off it, like all of us have done a million times before, well, I certainly have, you know, you only ever do better when you know better. When you leave that intact, you leave that microbiome in play, and, of course, those roots get decomposed, and, of course, they actually add to porosity in the soil. When you pull it out, you collapse all of that.
And the same, of course, with leaves. I went to visit the other Craig in Olinda at Gentiana Nursery. Yeah. Oh, and he's raking all these absolutely stunning leaves off his lawn and throwing them onto the garden bed. Mm. And it's, you know, it's thick with leaves. Mm. I was so jealous because I have got mainly gum leaves, which still, of course, I leave there. They're good, but they're not quite as gorgeous. Problem,
I mean, I've got some gum trees in the front in the nature strip, which inherently make their way into my garden. And, of course, sadly, eucalypts are allelopathic, which means that they've got a growth inhibitor in them. So over the edibles or the ornamentals, they're not really a very good place to have them.
But I take them out of my veggie garden.
Yeah, yeah. So on native gardens, it's fantastic, but, you know, not so good on the...
Well, you just mix other mulches with it. So oh, absolutely. It actually breaks that compound down.
Yeah, true, so, true. Yeah, very true, so. Yeah.
Do you mulch your beds in the hospital?
I do, largely for keeping moisture in and weed suppression. Mm. They're the main thing, as in until the other plants have got established, particularly ground covers and things like that, then they'll be the vegetation. But definitely where I can and however I can. So, yeah, absolutely vital from my point of view, from a... landscape maintenance and management point of view as well, and because that's...
And, of course, you're under a lot more pressure than we are to make your garden look respectable.
Well, yeah, I mean, our gardens, are, you know, we want to make sure they present well and are tidy and because we've got the variation of general spaces and also more detailed, intricate plantings and interest there. So... different spaces, we, you know, it's almost the base level, got to be able to be maintainable, manageable, and that involves supporting the plants that we've got, so therefore keeping moisture in the soil by mulching, and also then minimising where weed growth can happen, that we don't want the weeds, just so to keep it tidy. Mm.
And, of course, even in containers, I think that people don't mulch and they should. They don't know to.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In containers, I think it's more vital or just as vital because that's where you've got all your moisture and all the...
Yes, and you're losing it really quickly.
Correct. So there's that intensity of that. And depends on then the container, as you've also got the side. So you've got that in increase. You'd be well aware of that, Ben, with... potted stock?
I mean, you can water 2 to 3 times a day quite easily. It's, so it can be a bit tricky. So, and you can't go through and mulch every single pot of them.
No.
It's just too much. So, the best thing is we often apply a lot of sort of biostimulants as well.
Yes.
So we still try and have an active sort of biology in our potting mix as well. Because it'll tend to, you know, having a good biology will hold moisture in your soil, even in potting mixes. So, because the other day, like yesterday actually, I was finishing off weeding and mulching a garden bed, and it was full of moisture.
Yeah, great. Yes.
So, and we haven't had rain for how long now, and how many warm days? It's been, nearly 2 weeks?
It has.
And I still actually had a lot of moisture in this garden bed, and it's exposed to a lot of full sun, a lot of sunlight.
But you had a good mulch on it.
Yeah, but I had because I'm actually applying biostimulants, I'm actually feeding the biology. So not so much just the bacteria, but I'm feeding the fungi as well. So we actually have this symbolic relationship between the three, which is the bacteria, fungi, and the plants. Mm. They actually have the ability to actually hold moisture in our soils.
Mm.
So when you're not going to get that, you know, on hot days, you're not going to get less evaporation. Because like Craig was saying, keep your soil covered as well, and that protects everything and keeps everything at a good temperature.
I think one of the other things too that's forgotten in mulch is that it provides cover and stops the sunlight getting to the composting insects. That soil food web of insects, some you can see and some you can't, they hate sunlight. And if you've got no cover, they are not coming up to the surface and aerating the soil for you. eating away at that organic mulch layer, which is what's most important. I mean, and it's really that mulch layer is a bit like a forest floor, to use an analogy. We're, our role really as gardeners is to keep that in a constant state of decay. So continually feeding it often, just like a forest floor would be fed from above. And in my instance, what I do is I make the very best compost I possibly can, making it as diverse as I possibly can. And I actually sieve it, which sorts out what's finished from what's not. And the stuff that's not, I throw back on the compost, and I collect and I combine the worm castings straight out of the worm farm, and I mix the two together, and that tends to dry out the sludginess of the worm castings, because can they be a bit wet and sodden.
Yeah, yep.
And now I've got a broadcastable substance that I can now sprinkle over the top of the soil through the mulch layer, and I immediately water it. I don't do big areas because of that sunlight factor. So on, you know, overcast days or in the morning is best, so that we're not in a hot, sunny environment, and a couple of square metres at a time in amongst the plants. Some lands on the plants, that's okay, wash that off, and largely that makes its way down through the mulch layer, and that feeds the soil and, yep. and those composting insects. And like when I scratch back the mulch layer, you can hear this as the worms disappear. And it's fantastic because, I mean, that's taken a little while to get back. I mean, yeah, you know, yes. I was one of those when I horticulture college was taught plants need fertilizer. So, of course, you know, up until some time ago, I was fertilizing plants. I mean, yep. albeit organic, but now I don't feed a plant. I do not feed plants, I feed the soil.
Yes,
correct.
Yes.
And I feed this way.
Yeah, but the plants need the nutrients. And bacteria is and fungus is probably one of the best ways to actually provide the nutrient for the plants. Because there's things like molybdenum, which is actually a micronutrient that's not really available in our soils. No. So it's all locked up.
Yeah.
So the only way that we can access this is through the biology. So if you've got bacteria that's you know, having this symbiolic relationship with the plant. So the plant's actually going to tell the plant, I need molybdenum so I can make certain proteins. Mm. Then that bacteria will go off and solubilise that nutrient to a plant of fallible form so the plant can actually utilise it.
Of course, that's the important thing about the pH. You know, like one of the things that the pH does to a soil, if your soil is very acidic, and those plants that like acidic soil, they need that because the acidity of the soil is what releases the nutrients for them. And it's about the soil, not the plants.
Well, bacteria can change the pH of your soil.
Yes, absolutely.
So it's funny because, I mean, you can actually have, you know, like a plant, a sort of acidic-loving plant. So when that actually releases, like, this sticky substance, which is they call root exudates, it's actually communicating with the bacteria. So the bacteria will break down and solubilize a lot of these different nutrients and all that sort of stuff to change the actual pH of the soil. So it's actually an optimal level for that plant to actually sort of thrive in. So this is this whole communication.
Yeah. Mm. And that's largely about that internet in the soil I was talking about. I mean, one of the analogies that I use, and I started a little when I wrote my last book, is the blueberries in their natural habitat. And of course, the blueberries of today are not like they were. But when they investigated this, I mean, blueberries like a pH of 4.5, which is very acidic. So they tested soil in their natural sort of habitat, and they were getting blueberries at 4.5 or thereabouts. So, you know, not 900 millimetres away, less than a metre, testing another plant and a different species altogether, and the pH would be somewhere around about 6.5 or closer to 7.
Which is a much more middle of the range.
Of course, and then another blueberry a bit further on would be back down in that range. And what they realised was that the fungal and bacterial network were changing pH. The blueberries were lacing these exudates with flavonoids laced with sulphur. Enticing sulfur-solubilising microbes. What does sulfur do to pH? It lowers it. And they stop lacing those flavonoids with sulfur when the pH is right. So plants and microbes have always controlled pH. And we've got in the way of that thinking, we do a test and go, oh, well, we're in 7.5. Well, it's now we need to get that down.
Mm. So what you're saying there is that essentially the plant is creating its own space with its own pH.
Correct.
But you've actually got
in the roots in it, within its root network, as opposed
the
to
rhizosphere, the root zone.
Yeah, without as opposed to that whole zone being pH of 4.5, they've effectively
correct lowered the pH to suit their needs.
And you go somewhere like the Botanic Gardens, and you just see microclimates where there are where the soil is managed and is really different from one place to the next.
Yeah.
We all know that in our gardens that there are places where the where it's better or where it works better for this plant or that and.
But that's the key, though. Like, don't expect to just put a plant in and it's going to do everything for you.
No.
It's you've actually got to actually support or provide some sort of biology or some sort of
Well, it's a constant. I mean, you've got to continue
carbon or a sugar source to sort of start feeding that biology.
Yeah.
And then once you actually start getting that diversity in the biology, then you'll find the plant the bacteria will start changing the pH of soils and
of course with that diversity, plant diversity is the key to success as well, because with their own, if you plant plants in plenty of diversity, they bring with them their own unique microbes that are unique to them, but they actually help share resources between other plants, because some of them bring specialist microbes that other plants don't have, and they're able to unlock and solubilise minerals and nutrients that those plants can't get.
Because that all goes back down to their different sort of root depth as well. So you can actually have, your tap roots to some of your real fibrous type of roots, which are very close to the surface. And that sort of communication, where I think, gives you that sort of variance of where they can actually get the nutrients from too.
Yeah,
so.
I couldn't agree more. In fact, just recently I learned, I've been doing a little bit of work in weeds. Weeds tell stories. I mean, the reason a weed exists in the soil are for good reason, and that's, and often in a seed bank in soil. I mean, and there was a study they did a little while ago. They tested a farm, and around this farm, there were several hectares, every other adjoining farm had heaps and heaps of white clover growing, and yet there was no white clover growing on this farm, and I couldn't work out why. So they tested some soil, and they separated the soil from the seed bank, and then they sorted digitally the different types of seeds, and they measured in 1 square metre of soil that this farm that had no clover growing on it whatsoever had 2 kilos of white clover seed in that soil bank, in that seed bank.
Oh, okay.
And yet none of it was growing.
Yep.
And the reality was that he had available nitrogen in the soil, whereas the other farms, and they tested those, their nitrogen was locked up. So it's remarkable what happens when you understand why weeds grow. I mean, it's not that they, just because they blow into a garden or onto soil doesn't necessarily mean that they'll germinate. They're there for a reason. Some of them are to draw down nitrogen, and they fix nitrogen in soil, or are hosts to fix nitrogen.
Or even, lift calcium.
And that's the other thing. I mean, often big flat-bladed weeds are there to not only cover soil, but also to lift that calcium up into the region. Some of them are bioaccumulators.
And that's one of the important nutrients, I think, for that cellulose.
So, Craig,
yes,
I have got quite a lot of that big yellow weed, South African daisy, Cape daisy.
Oh, Cape weed?
Cape weed.
So compaction, number one, and calcium problem too.
So you would just leave it there?
I would, But I would, but it's an indicator. It's telling you something.
Well, it only grows in places that have been disturbed.
Okay, well, that's number one. So
and it grew really well during the drought when a lot had been disturbed.
Yeah. So the number one, deep, long tap-rooted weeds generally an indication of compaction. So the easiest way around that is to aerate the soil. So once you understand what the weed is telling you, you can use that to your advantage and reverse the conditions that it likes to grow in, and then it won't grow there. So that's as easy as it is. So aerate the soil, get some organic matter down into those aerated holes. That holds open the air. You start to get some air back
down
where it is.
And I think also cut and drop as well.
Oh, because absolutely.
They've also been drawing a lot of nutrients that are deeper into the soil, bringing it to the surface. So if you cut and drop, then you're actually releasing that nutrient back into the soil. So once you take that away, you're taking that nutrient away with it. So,
absolutely. Couldn't agree more, Ben.
Big believer in it. And if you want to be a bit more of a tidy garden, you just do that cut, drop, and then mulch on top of it.
Yeah.
So use a harder mulch on top of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then you find the biology will break it all down and hold that nutrient as it's breaking down, or hold that nutrient and feed any other plant that's actually around as well.
So provided it's not in weed seed, I always take the top of that weed and I compost it because of the bioaccumulation that it has in those leaves. So some of them are biodynamic accumulators and some are bioaccumulators. So the dynamic are actually exuding out at the root feeder level. of these exudates and weeds, of
can
course,
I,
are like
can mine. I slightly divert yeah. us because we've had a question in.
Yes.
Something's eating my clivias. What could it be?
Oh, jeez. Well, it could be a lot of things. Snails.
Do we worry?
Well, yeah, I guess you do. But, I mean, at the end of the day, often pests are an indicator, a bit like weeds. They're not necessarily the problem. The problem may well be existing in the soil. And if the plant's not getting the health from the soil that it needs, then it's open to insect attack.
I must admit, with my clivias, they get a little bit eaten and I don't worry about it because I figure if I don't have any snails or slugs, then there's a whole lot of birds that will be less happy.
Well, that's true. I mean, they'll go somewhere else, no doubt. I mean, it's not as if they don't exist, but yeah, it's just that they pick on different subjects.
Yes, I do worry about them more in my vegetable garden than in my whole garden. It's the same with caterpillars. People get really upset about caterpillars. No caterpillars, no butterflies.
Yeah, well, that's very true. I mean, and that's the other thing. I mean, you know, 75% decline in flying insects, so we need more of them. So
we do, yeah. I was just chatting with my dad yesterday. He's over in South Australia. He's 91. He had spent 4 hours watching the chrysalis convert. And so he's watching the caterpillar going in and then seeing the liquid get to it. So then now it sits there for 3 weeks. But he was watching it. So he said about eight in the bush were in the sitting there just all doing their thing. And he was like, he spent 4 hours just happily watching it. Mind you, the change happened in like minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was a couple of times when he had spent 4 hours and then had to go somewhere and missed it entirely.
You've got to hate that.
It was like, but absolutely amazing. Like, I guess what it reminds me, and that's the reason I mentioned it, is that's the fascinating things that happen, and we need those. We need to foster
those events.
Thank you. And because that's actually the ebbs and flows of our gardens and of the natural ecosystems.
And of course, some of them are food for other other insects and birds and lizards and the whole food chain. So I mean, it's one of those things. I mean, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't to some degree.
Well,
so
the only thing I don't want that's in my food chain is next door's cat.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you're not the Lone Ranger there, let me tell you.
It's probably not in the natural system of the environment. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. But when I came to my garden, I had no small birds.
I can lend you two Jack Russell Terriers if you like. There'll be no cats in your garden, I can assure you.
They would help with my rabbits too, I imagine.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, you need to take a shovel with you, though. Because one of my Jack Russell will go straight down a rabbit hole and often he's a little bit tubby.
Gets stuck.
Yeah, so if you haven't got a shovel, you might be in a bit of trouble.
Right.
So, yeah, every time I take him along the river for a walk, I used to have to take a shovel. So anyway.
That would have been a sight to behold, walking with your shovel.
Yes.
I have a very close friend in Dorset in England, and her dog used to do exactly the same. You go down the badger holes and get stuck.
Mm.
Oh, it drove her crazy.
Yeah, yeah. So,
he's getting a bit old now, so he doesn't do it as much.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I'd better remind everybody, this is the 3CR Garden Show. I'm Virginia Haywood, and with me this morning is Ben Brooker from Treasure Perennials, Craig Castry, regenerative gardener, and Stephen Wells, horticultural therapist and nurse. If you would like to ring us, you could do so on 94190155, or you could send us a text message on 0488 809 855. And if you want to send us next week a message, you do, or if you're podcasting, and you can do that on 3cr.gardening@gmail.com. And you can put a photo on there, whereas we cannot take photos on our texts. The computer doesn't like that. So do contact us. We'd love to hear from you. Yes, well, the other thing I wanted to tell you, because we were talking about blueberries, up in Warburton there's a blueberry orchard and they're all trees.
Mm.
It's just fabulous. You literally walk amongst these trees and they're blueberries.
Jeez. Trees.
They're small trees. They're only the size of, you know, a smallish crab apple, but they're still trees.
Oh, yeah, incredible.
I couldn't believe it the first time I went there. When I was in Alaska, I saw quite a lot of wild blueberries and thought, Alaska, Victoria, not slightly similar. slightly similar. Yeah. And they were wild.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they'd be the ones that I was talking about. Well, not necessarily in Elastica, but wherever they're native to. So yeah.
It was extraordinary. It was wonderful. Yeah. But I did see things that do terribly well. Weeds, things that we have as weeds that do terribly well in our gardens and were so happy in Alaska.
Mm.
I thought, this is most unreasonable. You shouldn't do so well in my garden. I don't want you.
I actually grow one of those at the moment, mullein.
Yep.
And I've got a two-year-old one that's now, would probably be approaching 2.4 metres tall.
A
mullein.
Verbascum.
Oh, verbascum,
yes. Verbascum thapsus. Yeah.
Nice. What colour is it?
It's grey silver.
Yeah, the yellow one.
Yeah, it's a yellow one, yeah. I've got a black one, but...
very weedy down the Bellarine Peninsula.
Yeah, no doubt. But, I mean, the key to success is to allow it to flower and not set seed.
Yes.
So, and that's a pretty of a unique thing because the way they flower, I mean, they're sort of an indeterminate flower. Yes, they don't just open all at once. They continually are opening, so...
So you've got some flowers and some seeds.
Yeah, that's exactly, yeah.
I haven't verbascum... A lovely verbascum in my garden,
yeah.
But I do pull it out and put it in the bin, in the green bin. But nevertheless,
yeah.
Look, I don't want those seeds.
I will for sure be using this for compost, no problem at all. But not so
is
much
that the reason
flowers.
You planted it?
No, well,
or did it plant itself?
No. We planted it. Kerry, my lovely wife, the apprentice, grew it from seed and. It was really for a medicinal scenario.
Yes.
I have a condition called COPD. It's a chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and this is heroed to help that, and I'm happy to say that it has.
Has
great.
It?
So, yeah. It's,
how do you take it?
So you use the one-year-old leaves. No good using the two-year-old leaves. They don't have anywhere near the potency that the one-year-old do, and I just use one leaf and chop it up. Put it into a fine microfilter tea pot because they've got an enormous amount of fine leaf hairs, what do you call them, trichomes. Mm. So you don't want that in the water. And then just pour boiling water over it, let it steep for about 10 minutes and then drink it as a tea. Occasionally we'll put a little bit of my honey in it just to sweeten it up. I've heard people say it sort of tastes like flavoured grass. I'm not sure about that, but, you know, it's a pleasant drink.
Yeah, yeah.
But it has really helped.
If it works for your health, whether it actually tastes pleasant or not is a little bit
irrelevant. Well, that's the truth. But structurally, it looks fantastic in the garden. And it's a bioaccumulator. And I'm growing a lot of annual plants around it as well. So that's another thing I think that we perhaps might talk about a little bit more, particularly how we've got an expert perennial grower in the house.
Yes, yes.
Before we do, we might just go to Fiona in Panton Hill because she's got an oxalis question.
Oh.
Good morning, Fiona.
Good morning. Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for all your wonderful expertise. I'm loving listening.
Good.
I have got a garden on the hill, so it's surrounded by lots of bushland, and you know I've got part in indigenous, but you know part vegetables and things. But oxalis is one of the kind of endemic weeds around here, which
the yellow one.
Yes, proliferates.
I used to have one of those problems myself, particularly in the front yard, not so much out the back, but I'm a reasonably diligent gardener, unlike a lot of my neighbours. And, of course, being out in the street where people don't mow nature strips that it's growing in, you inherently get the seeds. And so my workaround was to sharpen a Dutch hoe. And I simply slip that under the mulch and cut the top of the plant off and I leave the plant where it falls, a chop and drop scenario. If you pull that oxalis up, what happens is it splits the bulbs and you're pretty well propagating more of it beneath. So that's a bit of a...
And they come off. Like there's lots of little bulblets and they'll just... Yep. Easily
you're propagating
off.
Them. Correct.
Yeah, exactly right.
Almost,
so you're better off just
saying, thank you.
Yeah, yes, exactly right. Yeah, we'll grow some more now. Yeah. Thanks. You obviously want more, so here we come.
So nice, sharpened hoe.
Yeah, sharp Dutch hoe. It takes no time. But the key to success is to outcompete it. Plant the area out with plants and get some mulch over the top of where you've and leave the plants on the top of the mulch. That they'll decompose. Of course, if there's lots of them, and I suspect that there is the way you're talking, I just use the hoe, turn it upside down and draw the tops back to me and put them in a bucket and throw them in the compost all over the fence to the chooks.
Yeah, because the top's fine in the sense of composting. There's no, it's the seed, it's the bulb, not the seed, the bulb.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, exactly. So just to clarify, when I'm with the hoe, I am actually digging the root or I'm just taking the top off them?
No, you go beneath the mulch layer, hopefully you've got a mulch layer there, and if not, just underneath the soil to sever the top from the bottom and leave the bottom in the ground.
Okay.
Okay, so
working
plants
on
need
the principle, Fiona, that as soon as you disturb the little bulbs, they just spread.
Yeah, but the thing here is that plants need to photosynthesize. That's how they food. They make their own food.
Got it.
So if you keep cutting the top of the plant off, the bottom has to die. It's getting no food. So and if you outcompete it with growing other plants there as well, making it more difficult for the plant to grow, and of course keeping the area mulched, you'll lose the problem like I have.
It'll take a while.
But the trick is
it took me one season, and I'm rid of it.
There you go.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Get the diversity as well.
Excellent. Thank you.
Oh yes, very true. Yeah. Diversity is also the key.
Thank you, Fiona.
Good planting. Thanks
really
a lot.
Appreciate it. And all the best with your Dutch hoeing this afternoon.
Thank you. Good day to you. Well,
see ya.
Bye-bye.
I think that's I moved a plant in. I've got one section that's quite oxalisy, and I was moving a plant from there, and I wanted to put it right over the other side of the garden. I dug it up, and I'm carrying it over, and I suddenly thought, oh, I can't take it over there. There are no oxalis over there, so. I moved it within that section where I was because I thought I can't afford to dig plants out of there unless I completely wash their roots.
Yeah, no.
Just leave them.
And the thing is, I think it's silly for us to think that we're going to eradicate weeds because, like I said before, the seed bank in the soil, and everyone has it, and they can lay there dormant for 100 years or so. You know, they're finding places that, because people have gone down this regenerative path of using diversity and keeping soil covered and feeding soil, they're getting native species they haven't seen in 80, 90 years all of a sudden appear. Now, no one's planted that seed there. It's been regenerated through the seed bank.
What
conditions,
is the plant?
Oh, well, native species, grasses and all
whatever.
Sorts of, yeah, bits and
oh, well,
pieces.
Well, I found as soon as I took the horses out of my paddocks, I started getting kangaroo grass,
back. Yeah, kangaroo grass, bye-bye grass. You know, there's a whole host of
which means that those seeds can, you know, they lay dormant.
Well
for
the
quite
thing,
a while in that soil profile that you were sharing before
absolutely
when the conditions are right.
There's a lot of biology, microbiology involved in seeds, and it happens through a process.
Could you also please repeat the name of the verbascum because somebody else
Verbascum thapsus, thapsus.
Which
is
mullein.
Mullein, MULLEIN. And there is a black mullein as well. The one I've just described is the yellow mullein. They actually call it nature's toilet paper.
I can understand. It's pretty soft.
Yeah, well, it's got fine, leaf. As I say, it's got fine trichomes. It's really, really furry on the top. So if you're using it as a tea, I stress. You don't want to get those trichomes in that water. So you've got to have a fine micron filter teapot to use, or you put them in a
strain it.
Well, yeah, well, but finally, I mean, like through even a cheesecloth, you know,
or like a coffee filter, paper, or
yeah, coffee filter would be ideal. That's exactly what you want. Yeah,
yep.
So
that's the important part of it. Is
yeah,
so if you're thinking of using this method, you must have a good look. And know what you're doing.
Yeah, look, and check it. Yeah, look, I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, get some advice. Don't go just taking my – I mean, I'm not offering any whatsoever, any health advice in this. This is all I do, and that's, you know, so
which is the age-old thing.
Yeah.
Whatever we're saying, whatever you read, whatever you come across is
check.
Cross-reference, check, do some reading.
Yeah. Couldn't agree more.
And learn.
Yes.
Violetta from Lilydale, hello Violetta, has texted in that she's got mildew on her purple viola.
Mildew on her purple viola.
I'm surprised because it hasn't been wet.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's often a bit of humidity and a bit of warmth is just enough to set that off. again, a soil issue. if you wanted to spray something, you wanted nutrients. To get some lactobacillus.
Yeah.
So 50% milk and water sprayed over the plant, or even watered over it, would be fine. The lactobacillus bacteria will eat that mildew quickly. I'm surprised you're not getting black and yellow ladybird beetles, because they're a fungus-eating insect. So that's often the reason.
But that lactobacillus, you can actually, we actually have a recipe that I've did.
Yeah.
And I've got it on my Instagram page. Yeah. So if you want to actually learn how to make lactobacillus, you can just go on my Instagram page, which is at Treasured Perennials, and I'll have the recipe there. So
fantastic. Have a look at that, Violetta.
Because it is what it is. It's actually
Violetta has most of her, a lot of her plants in pots, so it could well be in a pot as well.
Yeah. So because what it is, it's actually a nutrient. So the plant's actually not producing a protein, so it all goes back to the biology as well. So if you feed the soil, then that's actually feeding the plant that what actually it actually needs to fight off against these particular diseases or bacteria problems.
We have another interesting message here from Jane in Greensboro. Good morning. A fascinating talk today. I have problems getting any peas to germinate with only about 20% success rate. Keeping the white clover case in mind, is it because there is too much nitrogen in the soil?
It is a possibility, but what I would do...
She does use a lot of compost when she's preparing the soil.
Okay, well, again, I would be making sure that it is finished compost, and that's the most important thing I can advise you. Because if you're putting on unfinished compost, it's very likely to be very high alkaline, which ultimately will start locking up things like calcium. Once you close down the calcium, then you're starting to lock down a lot of the trace minerals that, you know... help with these functions, you know, so particularly germination of seeds and the like. So my advice would be I would soak those seeds in a highly diluted biostimulant of some sort before I put them either in the ground or start them in seedling trays and transfer the...
like a biostimulant will be things like fulvic acid, humic acid, even something like molasses.
Yep.
You know, that's just something as simple as molasses. But don't go and buy it from the supermarket. You want to buy the molasses you actually get from a grain store.
Yes, absolutely.
Because there's different grades of it. Correct. So, yeah, because there's like you either can have it too much sulfur in one in certain varieties or they're being cooked and it's just too sugary.
Yeah.
So...
And Craig, you said you know the importance of the finished compost.
Yep.
What's that? What do you mean by that?
Sift it. So what I do is I rarely turn my compost over, but I make it in layers, so browns and greens. So one part brown to three parts green, roughly. I mean, it's not an exact science, but you know, and basically layer it in those levels, and then I just bandicoot from the bottom and I put it through a sieve, and what easily goes through the sieve is. Pretty well finished.
Yeah, good. So tell me more about the sieve, because you mentioned that earlier.
So
it's hooking my brain. I'm like, right, what do you... Because sieving me in the context of different particle size, so what
So 5 millimetre aperture size, roughly. Yep. So it's quite fine.
Great.
In fact, we use a 50-50 mix of it and koi fibre to raise our seeds, because there's biology in there, and seeds need to form the minute that they send that free radical root down... to form a relationship with the biology in the soil. That's what happens.
Yep.
And we're learning so much more about how important that is. So the more intact you can get those seeds, that's why I say soaking with biostimulant is a great way of being able to stimulate the biology. You see, biology exists around the outside of the seed coat, around the inside of the seed coat, around the embryo. Plants invest huge amounts of these when they go into their fruiting and flowering phase, and for good reason, because they lay dormant in the seed, in the soil, in that seed bank. And when the conditions are right, the seed is an inanimate object. It doesn't know whether it's a centimetre deep or 10 feet deep. How does it know when to germinate? How does it know is it winter, autumn, summer or spring? Whether there's too much nitrogen or not enough nitrogen? How does it know? It's the biology through biochemical signalling. So this is why it's important to get the seed in touch and stimulate it biologically. So that's why the biostimulants are perfect opportunity to be able to get that wonderful association started as early as you possibly can. And of course, if you can mix up that sifted compost and koi fibre and the like as a seed raising mix, you know, and water it in with a weakened biostimulant, I mean, happy days. You're going to get plenty of germination, I'm sure. So
I hope that is useful. That was Craig Castry talking about that. Today we have Craig Castry, Ben Brooker, Stephen Wells and me, Virginia Hayward, on the 3CR Garden Show, which has been a fascinating show this morning. We also have a text online which is very long, which makes it a bit hard to read. But basically it's saying, morning team, at the Waverley Garden Club meeting last Friday night, our guest speaker was none other than John Arnott, speaking about the Burradong Botanic Garden and Arboretum. And it's a great project, which John has been quite involved in. And this is a long text just saying what a brilliant speaker John was and how very interesting it was. So clearly, some of the other garden clubs might want to see if they can grab John to come and talk to them. It was John Arnott, of course, who is one of our very regular members here.
I was chatting with John's colleague, Andrea Proctor, who was involved, is involved with that.
Burradong.
Amazing. Like the brief conversation we had was just inspiring because it was, I think it's age-wise, is probably the oldest Australian native botanic gardens.
Mm.
And it's out, yeah, middle of New South Wales. Amazing. I'm not doing it justice by what I'm remembering from the conversation.
164 hectares of former farming country. Jeez. But it was rescued by a local farmer.
Yeah, it's just amazing. So I think I'd love to chat with John too and hear him talk more.
Well, he'll be in soon. So
correct,
absolutely.
Yes. We'll
ask him to talk about it. It'll be excellent. Yes.
Mm.
Now, you've both brought in some plants today. Oh. So do you want to tell us what your slightly tired looking plant is, Greg?
Well, I sort of I had hoped that it had been in better condition, but
very big leaves.
Yeah, it has. So, one of them is a cake.
Dug it up.
Yes. One of them is a cake gooseberry.
Yes.
And these were some of the easiest things to grow, seriously. I mean, and they grow in a variety of conditions. So it's in the Solanum family. And it grows this wonderful little berry. Have any of you tried them?
Oh yeah, I grow it.
They are just fantastic.
Love it.
Yeah.
The taste, I love the look. I've never actually tasted it.
I love
the look of it.
Yeah,
they are delicious, but they've got to be ripe. And the way to tell when they're ripe is when the actual cage themselves, and it comes as nature's bird cage, I reckon.
But they actually
becomes like a see-through cage, and you've got this beautiful golden berry in the middle of it, and they just look fantastic.
Could we put a photo up online after the show?
Oh, I'm sure we could. Yeah, I think no problem.
Looking at it here, it reminds me of a hot air balloon to start with.
Yeah.
But then when
a small one,
yeah, yes, not the big sky one.
But the berry gets about three or four times the size of the one that I've just opened here,
which is
probably gets about 25 millimeters in diameter.
Yes.
So when it's finished, but as I say, it's a beautiful golden.
I still remember
bronzy
the first
colour.
Time I ever saw it. It was when I was at university and I was walking through North Carlton.
Yeah.
And I still remember seeing it and thinking, oh, my God, that is so wonderful.
Yeah.
It's a hardy plant too. It's very sort of dry tolerant and it can self-seed as well.
Hasn't in mine.
Yeah.
Where do you like to plant it in your place, Ben? What kind of spot? Full sun, part shade?
Full sun. Yeah. So I've got it actually just on the outside of the nursery.
Yep.
So, but I've been trying to plant it other places. Like I've been doing we've got quite a large orchard, and I'm turning that into more of a forest, food forest. So a lot of it will be planted down into there as well. So, but it is, it's something that just, you sort of plant it, and once it's growing, you don't really need to just sort of do much to it at all. It'll do its own thing.
And so I grow it in the Yarra Valley.
Yeah.
You grow it in Werribee. Mm. You grow it in Gippsland for our overseas visitors. That is a very, very varied area covering 100 miles or so between us all if you did the round trip.
And different
soils.
Mine grows on the south side of the house, so it only gets morning sun. So it gets quite tall. It gets up to about 1.8 metres tall.
Now, for your environment there, is that because the afternoon sun is too hot?
No, it's because I can't afford the space.
Space.
I figure if you want to grow, that's where you're going to grow. And if you don't grow there, well, you're gone.
Yeah. But also, I would imagine it wouldn't massively like a hot north wind, which you must get.
Actually, we get it.
Yeah, okay.
So, like I said, I've got it in full sun. Yeah. And if we get a northerly and hot northerly, I've never seen it droop.
No, it's incredible. But it does self-seed readily, I assure you.
So you try and eat it before you let it self-seed.
Yes. And planted, in effect, a bit en masse, so it supports each other?
To some degree, yeah. That's solitary. Exactly what happens, yeah. Yep. So, I cut it back, I hack it. Seriously, if you saw how many times a year I chop this stuff back, and it's a vigorous grower in the good, in right conditions, you know, so
incredible. And Ben, incredible. What does it taste like?
Oh, I don't know. It's got like this nice sort of acidic sort of explosion, really.
It can be a bit tart.
Yeah, I actually...
But sweet at the same time, so it's a unique flavour.
I think it's got its own flavour.
Yeah,
it certainly does. Yeah. It's one of those flavours you just can't describe.
No.
But it's like when you do bite it, you do get this nice explosion of sort of fresh, sort of crisp flavour in it. So,
It's one of those things you're going to have to try. Make really good jams.
Yeah. I was going to say, slightly converting into the gardening cooking show, how do you eat it by itself?
Oh, yeah.
Or do you have it in another form?
I throw it in amongst some yogurt.
Yes,
and or some organic
even
oats.
Like a fruit salad sort of thing with just a bit of honey.
Great,
that's all you need. Yeah. So
and when I'm out in the garden, I pick a handful of them and
they don't make it inside.
No,
yeah, great. No. Now you said you hack it. What's that look like? How far down?
Oh, you can hack it right the way down to knee height if you wanted to. So from that high, I don't do it that much, but it's just because it's right beside a path.
Yep.
And it's on the left-hand side of an archway where we grow scarlet runner beans. So we've got four archways that have all got scarlet runners over. So, of course, if it's not the scarlet runner beans, I'm either hitting my head on the beans or the vine growing in the way. It's the Cape gooseberry starting to try. So I'm sort of hacking back both.
So, and can you remember what the Cape gooseberry's name is? Doesn't matter. Cape gooseberry, if anybody wants to look it up, they'll find it under Cape gooseberry. I did know, but not at this actual moment.
Yeah.
I'll just say this is the 3CR Gardening Show. If you would like to ring us, we are on 94190155. Or if you want to send us a message, 0488 809 855. And I might also just remind you all that today the RBG, Royal Botanic Gardens in Melbourne, the South Yarra Botanic Gardens, is having their Friends Growing Sale. So that will definitely be worth a look if any of you fancy popping over to Melbourne Botanic Gardens today.
I was at the Botanic Gardens yesterday catching up with some friends, and we were sitting in the Tacoma Pavilion, and every now and then I saw some people walking along with potted plants, and I'm like... And they were great. Like this one that I saw in particular was good vault size. Like they're not small stock necessarily. There was salvias that I saw, and it was just like, wow, this is great to see people going through it. So it's Sunday, so Saturday's the first day, and everyone piles there. They said they had a great response, apparently, and a lot more than they were expecting.
But they'll still have stuff today.
Yeah.
And they do that. Meg Bentley, who's one of our regular listeners, Salvia Meg, as I call her.
Yes, Salvia Meg.
She has introduced a lot of salvias into the garden, so they've got some really unusual and wonderful salvias there now. So they're not hard to propagate, so they'll be for sale, which will be wonderful.
Yeah,
I think the salvia, they've
got a lot of stuff there. I've run a couple of workshops for them over the years, and it's a fantastic space. They do a great job.
Yeah.
Phasaelis peruviana is the name of that.
The pH.
Yes, pH, yes, exactly.
For the Cape gooseberry.
Yeah. The other one that I brought in is a Yarkon.
Which I have in my garden.
Yeah, which is Smallanthus.
I got mine from the other Craig.
Yeah. So, and they are absolutely delicious. But, again, they're a tuber, this is only a very small one. I mean, they grow size of sweet potatoes. They're in the Asteraceae family, the sunflower group. But they're not like the Jerusalem artichoke. They don't have the flatulence problem that they do. But similarly, you want to make sure you harvest them each year, because otherwise they have a propensity to really mat up hard in the soil, and you know, and they do spread a little. So, but they grow to about I guess up to about 2 meters tall. They have a dainty small yellow daisy flower.
Mine
on
are
them.
In flower at the moment.
So yeah, they're a pretty thing, and they tend a bit like the solanum that we spoke of earlier, the Cape Gooseberry. They help to grow to support one another.
Okay.
You know, so but delicious and really, really good for you in terms of your health.
And you can use them in all sorts. You can
stir fries fresh. I like them fresh. I mean, they taste a bit like a water chestnut to some degree.
Or a nashi pear.
Or nashi pear, exactly. Yeah. That's very crisp. Good. Crisp, yeah, really, really crisp.
Yep.
So, yeah, excellent. Great health food. Good food for losing weight, as a matter of fact.
Right.
And they, another one that have a thing in them called inulin, not insulin. Inulin.
Yes.
So, yeah, very good.
Because you actually got to eat it, but you got to eat it before you actually have a meal.
Yeah.
For it to actually be as a weight loss. Yeah.
It's a digestive, yeah. So, it gets the microbiome active, and that's what it's all about, feeding that.
Is it the inulin that helps with the weight loss?
I'm not sure that it is, but it is one of the things that helps.
I know that it's got, because my daughter can't eat inulin, so it's one of those ones I'm growing that she can't eat.
There's several compounds in yakon that, it sort of it makes you feel a bit more full.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of other different sort of...
I think there's a trigger in there that actually excites the GLP-1 hormone, which is the satiety hormone.
Yeah, because there's like I said, there's several compounds and they all
makes
do
it
different.
Feel full, So it's great plant. Look it up. I mean, they're probably not all that easy to get in plant nurseries, but there are some that actually have it.
Well, yeah, great.
So ask them to order it in.
And I would imagine that Craig at Gentiana Nursery has that because he gave me the one in my vegetable garden, which has got too big. I think I'm going to move it into the garden.
And how often do you harvest that, Virginia?
Not often enough, clearly.
So, yeah. And that's the thing. I mean, you know, share the love. Harvest them. If you don't use them, then pass them on to some others that might, you know. It's a great space user, you know. So if you've got that awkward spot.
It can
go
in near the Jerusalem artichoke.
Yeah, well, there you go. They'd be happy there, I'm sure. Yeah. One would outcompete the other.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Very good.
Now, Ben, you've brought in a few plants as well, some that look vastly different but in the same family.
So, yeah, I actually brought in two Muhlenbeckias. So everyone's familiar with Muhlenbeckia complexa, which is the climbing Muhlenbeckia.
New Zealand, and they call it the wire plant because it covers an ugly wire fence so effectively.
Yeah, well, I've actually got another one that's actually from New Zealand as well, which is the bush form. So it's Muhlenbeckia astonii. So it's a shrub form, so probably about sort of 2.5 metres in height. But the branching, it sort of has this sort of zigzagging sort of branching effect. But each noodle point, which is where it starts to fork out to a different direction, you actually have this beautiful sort of heart-shaped leaf in it. So it's not a very dense sort of looking plant when it's young, but when it gets mature... It's quite dense. You can sort of see it can get really, really thick. But it's the structural effect of the branching.
The branches are quite geometrical, aren't they?
They are. They're absolutely beautiful.
And would you agree with me that is a very New Zealand-looking plant because of that branching, that type of branching is... You see that in New Zealand plants and not really very many other places at all.
No, you don't, no. So, but the flower is these beautiful, pure white, very succulent, juicy sort of type of flower. So it actually has like these four lobes, only small, with this sort of black centre. So if you squish them in your finger, you actually squish all this moisture out of it.
Is it a bit like a tea tree looking flower?
No. So it's like a tiny little bell shaped flower that sort of faces directly outwards.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but they're four lobes. But like I said, they're very sort of succulent type of a flower. They're not a normal sort of type of petal.
I have to look it up.
Yeah, it is something that's different. So, but like I said, it's once it's mature, it's about 2.5 metres at the most. So it's not a very large plant.
And width, Ben?
It's about the same in width as well. Yeah. But even just as a pot specimen, I think it'll look fantastic. Yeah, just it would nice be. Large yeah, pot.
Absolutely.
Bonsai, yes. You know, because you've naturally got that sort of distorted sort of, you know, branching. So, yeah.
I'm thinking of it as in a good sized pot, feature pot with some beautiful cascading plants down the side. So you've got the feature in the middle with that, that looks like a bonsai and or a wire bush. Effectively.
Yeah, well, that's probably what they call the common name is wire bush. So, yeah. But there, another variety I brought was the Muehlenbeckia platycladia. So this is completely different.
It is so different.
This one actually comes from the Solomon Islands and even from New Guinea as well. So it produces hardly any foliage, but it's the stems that's actually photosynthetic. So you get this really beautiful, nice, flattened sort of stems on it.
Which actually look like leaves.
They do, yeah. Ribbons. But that's what's actually photosynthetic.
Actually, when you brought it in, I asked whether it was a terrace fern.
No.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's what it looks like.
It does look like a fern, doesn't it?
It's incredibly fern-like.
It is. So instead of being a white flower, this is a yellow flower. Mm. But when it's pollinated, you get these beautiful sort of succulent red berries on it. Mm. So having that against that nice lime green sort of stems, it actually, they said it's quite attractive.
And where do you grow it, Ben?
So in a shadier position, so probably morning sun, afternoon shade. You can use it as an indoor plant as well, so it does handle indoors really well. Where it initially does come from, it is that sort of more subtropical sort of regional area. So if you do get really heavy frosts, it's not going to like it very much. So often we keep it in a spot where the frost won't settle on it. Even under trees,
I can't imagine that. It'd grow very happily in Mount Macedon, for example.
I don't know.
Druins, probably.
Yeah, we get pretty cold where we are, and we've been planting it under our oak trees.
Yes, which is huge.
Yeah, and it'll love it under there. Mm. So, you know, nice rich soil. Mm. So when it does, if we do get a nice heavy frost, it's not going to settle on it. It'll settle around the actual tree.
And dimensions of size, I mean, not a big grower?
I think it's about the same. So it only gets to probably about 2 metres in height. Mm. So it's not something, but you can keep it pruned down as well. Yeah. But even as a pot specimen. Mm. So, you know, because even as a pot specimen, you're actually restricting the growth of it as well.
Probably not a bad bit of advice too, because that way you can chase some shelter from cold nights and...
Yeah, you move it around. Bring it inside because you can use it as an indoor plant as well.
Yeah.
So, even if it's not flowering, I mean, structurally it's quite attractive.
When we go and have coffee afterwards, we'll definitely put that online because it's worth.
Yeah, it's incredible to see the two
between the two. It's extraordinary.
You would not. You'd swear that there's no way known they're the same plant. The same
family. I imagine the first one, the wiry one, would make a very good.
Bonsai
plant. I'm picking Chinese gooseberries, Chinese quinces at the moment.
Oh, nice.
And they're absolutely delicious. You know, throw them in the oven and then deal with them after they've softened a bit. And they're absolutely delicious. But this time last year, I grew them all from seed and I've got about 10 of them scattered around. And they've been in there for 20 years, so they're big. They're bigger than me. They're full size.
Mm.
And Craig came in, dug one up, which was one hell of a big job last winter, cut it down to 8 inches, and has bonsai'd it.
Wow.
That'd be incredible. Yeah.
He'll say, I'll drop round to his place and say, oh, do you want to come and see Bonsai VH?
Because you've
got into bonsaiing, haven't you?
I have, yes. Just recently I've gone back to it. I used to do it years and years ago at a wholesale nursery and I used to love doing it. You know, it's just fantastic. And the beauty was that because we were wholesaling, I got to practice my trade. So I had a huge scope of and experience, you know. So, and when I shifted to Werribee, I swore that I would populate the side fence, put shelves up there, and fill up where opposite Kerry's office window, full of bonsais. But life got in the way, and it never happened. And just recently, I was gifted, a couple of years ago now, 2 Kalamata olives. But I mean, I don't have room where I live for 2 more olive trees. So. I managed to kill one, sadly, But through neglect.
Through neglect.
I threw these two, hoping that someone would come to my place one day and I'd be able to gift them, you know, an olive, but that never happened. And one of them died through neglect, as I say, and the other one was showing some signs of life, but it needed a severe cut back from the weather. It had died back. I mean, you know what olives are like. It's pretty tough. So yes. Anyway, so I was sad to admit that, but, you know.
I'm always pulling olives out.
Yeah, yeah. So I looked at this poor, sad thing, and I thought, the only way I can keep you is if I bonsai you. So I looked up the sideway where our pots are placed, and I found an old bonsai pot. So I thought, right, come with me. And that's what I did. I resurrected this thing, and happy days, it's just love and life.
And has that kicked on further?
It's one of the better bonsais. Yeah, it's one of the better bonsais that I've done a long, long time ago. Oh. So I'm now up to about 35 bonsais. Now, that's only about 3 or 4 months ago now. So my local nurseries are wanting me to wholesale bonsais to them, so I've gone back down that path.
Yeah, good.
Wow. So, yeah,
I'm... Who would have thought a dying olive has reinvigorated?
Yeah, well, look, and I won't sell that now. It's you know... but I've just recently done quite a lot of azaleas and camellias, and, they look just fantastic. So...
great.
Yeah, but happy to be back doing what... I can't believe I waited so long. I love it.
What is it about it that you love about doing them?
I think the creative side of it and turning something. I did a liquid amber just 2 days ago, which was probably about 5 or 6 foot tall, and I pulled that back down to 2 feet, and you would swear, that the tree was only ever that big, you know, so all wired up. And of course, I hunted down to the orchard scurrying. If someone had a similar, what the hell is this bloke doing? I was underneath all the nursery tables picking up all the moss that I could find. So I had a bucket full of moss, which I, of course, then sit on the top of the soil in the bonsai pots. So, yeah, it's really good. I'm very, very happy that I've gone back to doing it.
It is very much a project of love. It's not quick, and you can't neglect.
No,
it teaches you patience.
Yes,
there's no two ways about that.
Process. And,
I've got some in train. I've got a couple of black pines that I've twisted and really deformed to some degree that I've turned a black pine without taking anything off it to about a third of its size through twists.
Yep.
So, you know, there are some things you unbelievably can do to plants you would not believe your eyes until you saw it happen. There are others it will just snap.
I have to say, my quince, which was, as I said, a fully grown tree.
Yeah, is now in a small container.
Is now bonsaied beautifully. Extraordinary.
Well done, Craig.
It's incredible. So
I have to say, though, the quinces taste wonderful. It's a bit, I would want the quinces.
Oh,
I think the Chinese quince is such a good quince to eat.
Yeah. Look, I mean, being a bit of a fruit enthusiast, I am on the hunt for some decent fruit trees I can find to bonsai. So anyway, it requires a lot of walking through nurseries, which is going to be a good thing.
You can always have one of my quinces. I do have a lot. I grew them all from seed.
Yeah. What about these, Ben? What are these others that you brought in?
So I've got another one. It's actually from South Africa, a Stromeria. Is it Geminata? Is it Geminata? So because Geminata refers to jewel. So it's only a tiny little plant. It's only probably, maybe about 20 centimetres in height. Mm. And the flower head has this beautiful sort of like firecracker, sort of this nice sort of umbel of sort of lemony coloured sort of star shaped flowers, but the petal of the flower is quite crinkly, so it's not a very sort of flat leaf petal, so it's actually got a nice sort of sort of twist to it, and then your stamens and stigmas sort of stand above it, so it's like another firecracker within a firecracker, if it's a good way to sort of explain the actual flower head.
Nice and delicate looking.
Yeah, but it's quite hardy, so it is a geophyte, so it is a bulb.
Yes.
Explain geophyte.
So geophyte is actually like it's basically a bulb. And it grows beneath the actual ground. But its mechanism of actually protecting itself, because it's so delicate looking, it'll actually go back into the ground over summer. So it protects itself from the hot, you know, harsh conditions where it comes from. So this actually comes from the Western Cape, northern parts of Western Cape of South Africa.
And when you say it's a tiny plant, you're not kidding. It's like, have a look at the size of the leaves.
Oh, the leaves are only just starting. So the flower comes through first.
They're just starting to come back up.
Yeah, so the flower comes through first. And when it flowers, it pollinates its seed and then the foliage comes through.
There's quite a few at the moment that are doing this, aren't they? The flowers are coming up and the leaves follow.
Yeah. Yeah.
It does make I think it makes them really interesting.
It does.
Like those big blood lilies.
Well, it makes you see the actual flower. Stunning. Yeah.
Yes. The flower has its moment to shine.
Yep.
Nothing to compete with it.
That's it. Yeah.
And then particularly the blood lilies, you see them come out, and their leaves are amazing.
Massive.
Size.
Yeah.
Almost compete, like totally contrast the actual size, the flower. In regards to volume,
what they do is when they set seed, as the seed drops, the foliage comes over and protects the actual seed, because the seed's not buried in the ground; it's actually on top of the surface.
Yes.
So, when the foliage comes out, it actually sort of protects the plant, so it keeps it moist, keeps it cool. So it'll germinate underneath the foliage, and then when the foliage dies back, then that actually will come out more. And so when they mature, the foliages will actually not cover each other, they will actually sort of fold out to a direction where they're sort of allowing each individual bulb to grow. Mm. So there's a reason why the flower comes first, so it can set seed and then drop the seed, and then the foliage can protect
the seed.
Yeah, it keeps it cool and moist. Yeah. Mm.
We have a message from Paul, who lives in the inner city and has been trying to grow his verge. And is just struggling because so many people let their dogs use it as their toilet.
Mm.
He wants to know if we have got any ideas of what he could plant there to deter the dogs. Now, obviously, he probably can't plant something that gets too high because you will restrict vision.
Yeah, well, I think you've got to keep it down lower than 900 millimetres.
So we want something that's a bit prickly and unpleasant, really, don't they?
Well, they still do it. They still get.
Yeah. It depends, really. I suppose grevilleas might be a good choice. Some of the lower growers.
Yes, because they'd be uncomfortable.
Well, yeah,
that's
I
what
think
we want.
That
things that'll make the dogs uncomfortable.
They might lift their leg once, but they may not do it again.
Well, I guess the other thing too there is there's the urinating and there's defecating. So to urinate, they do that on anything, regardless of size. Mm. Whereas I'm just wondering about the defecating, if there's something...
It should be getting picked up.
Well, there's that, let's not go there. but I'm just thinking if obviously it's about choice and what plants you want to put into the verge, but if there's plants of substance, they're not necessarily going to back into it and...
No.
Drop anything, so planting things that then maybe give a bit of volume and height
low to grevilleas those parameters. Again, it makes a lot of sense.
And maybe some subtly prickly grevilleas.
Yeah.
So
and some of them are subtly
prickly. Yeah, absolutely. Correct. Yeah, yeah. Grevillea white wings spring comes to mind.
Yep.
And there are a couple of ground cover ones that Grevillea gouty chowdy is one that...
That is a nice one.
That's particularly nice to look at, lovely... Brush red flower, toothbrush type, and it has a holly-like leaf, which has small prickles on the end of them. I mean, they're not severe, but they're enough, I would think, to deter
different texture
a marauding dog deciding wanting to do its
Paul,
thing.
Well, I hope that helps. And Janine in Frankston, she has got an animal problem too. What can I do about the rats and possums stealing my feijoas? Will they ripen if I pick them and take them inside?
They can, but you've really got to put them with something like a banana or an apple that emits ethylene gas.
Yeah.
They're better off left on the plant, to be honest.
And the natural
sugars
then.
You can, of course, buy... the trouble with a feijoa is that it's often too high, but you can buy those little bags to put over your fruit.
Yeah, yeah, you can. The problem I find with those is that they don't breathe terribly well, and you can often incorporate a mildew problem around the fruit. One of the best deterrents that I've come across over the recent years, and it's sort of a fairly inexpensive solution to what can be a costly problem, is a motion-activated sprinkler. And they're run on a 9-volt battery. You can plug a clip-lock hose up to them. They've got a spike. You just push them into the ground and they're configurable. They've got a a motion activator on them, so whenever you walk close to them, they give whatever is walking close to them a 3-second burst of water. So it's not going to run your build.
That's a good idea.
And as I say, configurable, you know. So
gosh, we could use that in a whole lot of other applications, couldn't we?
So I know I've had clients that have had deer problems that solved the deer problem, rabbit problems, yep. Bird problems, well, Ben, possum problems.
Ben so, of the figs was having terrible problems with his figs with the bats,
yep.
The big fruit bats.
Yep.
Right.
And he found that they only ever came between 9 and 10:30.
Yep.
So he set up exactly water. He had it so it came on at 9 o'clock.
Yep.
And then went off,
yep.
Half an hour later.
Yep, yep.
And that would deter yep. them. And after he stopped, of course, after the harvesting had happened and everything, and he said it still took them ages to come back.
Yeah. So I think if they do a quick search online, there's plenty of them on the shopping channels. They're under $100, and they're a fairly cheap solution too. And let me tell you, we had a huge possum problem down at the orchard with possum stripping the leaves off our young grafted fruit trees, which yep. was not much fun, let me tell you. And, of course, being on Parks Victoria land, we weren't allowed to do anything other than something passive. So these solve the problem, no problem at all. And when you forget to turn them on, turn them off and they get you, you'll soon realise why the possum stays away, I can assure you. It gets me every time when I walk in there.
Yep.
We've eventually wound up turning them off because we found that the solenoid click of turning that on without the water was enough to deter them. They heard that click.
They learnt.
They were gone.
They knew that was what was coming. Yeah, that makes sense.
So try that and see how you go.
And Chloe has texted in, Grevillea scarlet sprite is subtly prickly.
That's a good one. Yes, absolutely. Very good choice. Chloe. Yep.
And Jill's also mentioned that the crimson Vilea.
Grevillea crimson Vilea. Vilea.
Yeah.
80 centimetres tall,
yep.
is very prickly and good food source for bees. So a bit of a win-win there.
Yep.
And she's that available in most places, but she has got hers from the Yarra View Nursery up in Mount Evelyn.
Yeah, look, there's so many cultivars that you probably fit that brief. I think that it's just a case of getting out and having a bit of a look, going to a really good native nursery and have a really good look about. There might be some small Banksias too that might do that as well.
Yeah, I think whether it's prickly or not is one thing, but whether it's maybe what got me thinking of it was the volume, if it's a bit of substance.
Filling up the space.
So maybe there may be other preferences. I think it was Paul.
Yes, it was Paul. Well, let's hope. And aren't our listeners wonderful?
Yes, absolutely.
On the text,
absolutely,
with the ideas.
Yep.
It's what we need.
All helps. All helps.
It does. Yeah. It certainly does.
Now, there was one more that you've got there, Ben, that I'm admiring here. What's the other plant you brought in?
Well, this is actually a terrestrial orchid. It's one called Spiranthus, or Spiranthi. So this one actually comes from Canada, and it can go right down into the southern parts of the United States as well. So it's a quite hardy little plant. Like, it's only probably gets to probably about maybe 30, 40 centimetres in height. A nice sort of sunny location. We do protect this from late afternoon sun. So you get that sort of grassy sort of type of sort of leafy sort of form to it. And then you get this beautiful sort of nice pure white sort of flower spike to it. So each individual flower, it's like a duck's beak opened.
Yes.
So that's when you look at it closely, that's what it actually looks like.
Mm.
And like I said, it's quite easy to grow. And it's just that nice sort of front of border, you know what I mean? Like, it's sort of that nice sort of fill-in sort of type of plant that we actually use in our garden. Mm. And there is also native varieties too. So you we've got the is it called an onion orchid?
Gets
a nice, it's a very sort of thin grass-like sort of flower spike, but you get these little green little sort of hooded sort of orchids coming off it. Mm. Yeah, so
sounds yummy.
Yeah,
not wrong.
Yeah, so but this is the American form. So
very nice.
Very good.
So my question, I think, because it's the thing I'm doing at the moment, is putting in winter. I've put my garlic in. I've put in my broad beans. They're coming up nicely.
Mm-hmm.
So what are people planting at the moment for food?
Well, I'm sort of doing a bit the same. I mean, I've got garlic up about 6 inches now. One of my I don't plant garlic together, though. I plant it here and there.
Oh, as in individual scattered varieties?
For me, I mean, I've got raised garden beds, about eight of them, and they're sort of 8x4, more or less. And I think about companion planting. So what goes well on the plate together goes well in the ground together for me. So I start when I'm thinking about garlic, I think, okay, where am I going to put a tomato? Because tomato, basil and garlic, marriage made in heaven on the plate, and they do reasonably well in the ground together. So I think about, and I don't ever grow tomatoes together, so it's only ever one tomato, so I surround that with a circle or a ring of garlic in about a metre or so diameter. And then when it comes time, tomato time, I whack that in, and then some different types of basil, you know, a Greek and a Genovese and maybe a Ruffles or a whatever. So, and then I think about salad bowl. So what would I plant around that? So in the meantime, in the cooler months, so what am I going to surround the garlic with? So all the Asian greens, so bok choy, pak choy, choy sum, you know, some of the broccolis and collies. And then, of course, swedes and parsnips have just gone in. So
you grow parsnips?
Yep, absolutely.
Now that's a good thing. Not many people do.
That's because we're not very cold.
No, good stuff. Good thing to grow.
Yep. So you've obviously that's something you've been planting for a while, years, or is that something more recent?
I've always done
that's
that.
That's a regular.
50.
Yeah, great.
So, but I've now recently started to incorporate a perennial in every bed, at least some too. Because it's about, for me, getting that function back in soil, always soil first for me. And I'm mindful of it because I haven't been over the years. I mean, I was taught differently. And when you understand that this is the key to everything, and when the things you can't see, if you're not feeding them and helping them out with diversity, then you're nowhere. You get negative effects. I mean, and there's no right or wrong in any of this. There's just different outcomes. So for me to get really good nutrient-dense food, I need to maximise how I grow these things. So annuals, by and large, put a lot of their energies into the top of the plant, but they don't do a lot for the soil. They do a little bit. But perennials, they're a different kettle of fish.
So perennial basil, I presume?
Well, yes, to some degree. But, I mean, I'm growing things like samphire and wood betony and all these different other...
Samphire's delicious too.
It is, but it's a perennial and it's going to, by and large, even though it's, you know, it's a small fine leaf plant, but it's still one of those perennials that's going to pump more carbon back into the soil, and I surround that with some of these annuals.
I've got turmeric as one of mine.
Yep. So I've got turmeric out the front in my... And I'm actually growing some ginger reasonably successfully, and they're sort of a semi-aquatic... along with some of the other, do you know yerba mansa?
No.
That's another go-to cola. Do you know that one? That's also another semi-aquatic. Granny's bonnet, you'll know.
Yes.
You know. Yep. So those are some of the.
Granny's bonnet's not aquatic.
No. But it's near that area of these in this garden. So sort of semi-shade, dappled sun. So I've gone down the path of thinking about perennials, but also including the medicinal plants as well where I can, and then surrounding those with the annuals. The front yard, backyard is heavily embedded with, you know, flowering plants, as many as I can fit in. Full gardens grow no weeds. Mm. And that's music to my ears. I don't have the time to be mucking about with weeds, you know. And if I happen to come across a weed, I interrogate it first. I find out who you are, what you like to grow in, and then I try and reverse.
All right, I just had this little vision of this little dark room.
Under the light. Yes, right.
Who are you? What are you doing here? And why have you come?
Exactly right. And that's, I think, if more of us did some of that, you would soon learn how to reverse where they're growing. So if you've overdone it with the manure, you are going to stimulate the growth of stinging nettles because they're there to take out the overaccumulated nitrogen. You know, if you're getting onion grass,
if you get them young enough.
Yeah, well, of course. I mean, they're fantastic, but just make sure you do cook them. Mm. don't go picking them. I used to have an apprentice once who said, oh, look, mint. And before I could get the words out of my mouth, he had it in his lips.
So
he never did that. And, of course, every time we walked near nettles, oh, look, mint, Pat. You know?
Experience is the best teacher.
Absolutely. Yeah, he never did that again, no, I can assure you.
I remember growing up, we had a lot of stinging nettles around, and you learnt not to walk barefoot in the, across that paddock.
Oh, of course, yeah. But these are the things. So I think if we learn a little bit more about why something is... Nature is very clever. Nothing is out of... things are out of balance, these are the first responders. These are pioneer species. They are there for good reason. They're there to repair the soil. Mm. And once they have, then the successional plants move in. And this is how that works. So if you've got something out of whack and you've got a mess of these particular weeds, you need to find out why. And they will tell you why, for their very reason as to why they're there. You know, the microbes have been activated in the soil because you've disturbed the soil. Or you've got it out of whack, you've got it acidic, and now you've got onion grass. Well, that's why.
Yeah.
And Ben, are you planting veggies at the moment?
Well, I've been sort of focusing on the garden, not so much the vegetable garden at the moment, so... so we're just trying to get...
Because you're thinking of having an open garden next year, aren't you?
Yes, we are.
End of this year?
No, not this year, next year. So we're trying to get as much done as we can, so...
Excellent.
Yeah.
I'll sit on the gate again.
Yeah, so we weren't going to talk about that just yet, but you've just released it.
Sorry, but it's not this year, so it doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't.
People will forget, it's okay.
So, we've still got to do a lot yet, so yeah, we've already created new garden beds.
We do have a question for you, Ben.
Yeah.
I bought a Masonia from Ben at Fernie Creek. When should I change its pot?
You can do it now. So put it into a nice sort of terracotta pot. It doesn't really matter, but I think the trick is when you plant Masonia, you've got to plant it high. So I always mound it above the actual rim of the pot, because once the soil settles, it'll actually settle flat level, because you want the foliage to stay above the actual lip of the actual pot itself. Mm.
Specifically with the Masonia, or
with the Masonia, because the leaves actually they really hug the ground, yes. So nice and tight. So I think if you can actually have it above the actual lip of the actual pot, you actually see the plant, because some of the Masonia foliages are actually quite beautiful. They're very textured. Some of them have got some beautiful colours in them, and then when they flower, then you can get these beautiful sort of multiples of like these little star-shaped flowers that are clustered sort of quite tight together in the centre of it. Some are quite fragrant. Some actually have some beautiful blues to whites sort of colourings in them. Mm. So they're sort of quite attractive. So I think when you actually have them where they're sunken down below the rim of the actual pot, you don't sort of tend to notice it very much. Mm. So I think that's why you can lift them.
Mm.
We've had a message back from Paul. He's really pleased with our spiky suggestions. And somebody else has texted in suggesting he goes from some of the spiky acacia.
Oh.
But he now wants us to think about smells that dogs might detest.
Mm, I would have to do a bit more research for that one. But
we might put that out to next week's
notice,
mob.
Yeah.
See if they can come up with some ideas.
I might text him what I find. Yeah. That's not an uncommon question, to be honest. Good idea. I think that requires a bit more investigation.
And could we go back to the possum deterrent again, please?
Yes, no problem. So motion-activated sprinkler. As I say, it runs on a 9-volt battery. It's very easy, configurable. It has a motion activator on the front of it. You can make it detect much bigger or smaller things, so you can actually... detect a rat or a bird.
Is that a particular product or just?
It's called a motion-activated sprinkler. Activated. So there's probably different brands. As I say, they're less than $100 and they're a very cheap alternative to what can be a very expensive problem to sort out. And in fact, we've had great success with possums and rats.
Yeah, cool.
Thanks,
Kerry, for asking that again.
Motion-activated sprinkler.
Yep, cool.
So, yeah, and as I say, the beauty is there's no plumbing.
Yeah.
You know, and if you've got, you could put one in either corner of your yard and have them you know, activate in a 90-degree fashion. You, as I say, they do nearly a 300-degree radius. So they can do a long way, and you can make them go a long way, you know, 6 metres.
Yep.
Or quite short and fanned.
It's interesting, you know, for me that two people in 2 days have suggested the same thing.
Oh, how about that?
Yeah. And Ben with his, he was actually using it on a crop in a paddock.
Yep.
And he only needed it for the 2 hours.
Yeah, there you go.
He really got to know his bats first.
Yeah, yeah.
And realised that the time that they came was quite short.
Yeah.
And that was when the sprinkler system just leapt to mind.
I think, look, that's the thing. The key to success with all of this is a lot of observation. You know, try and detect exactly what is the problem and when is it. You know, that's the other thing. I mean, the clivia problem before, you know, perhaps get out in the night time, get out a,
with a torch.
And have a look and see what's, you know, the nocturnal insects and you know, things that are likely to be chewing on those clivias. Well, you're going to find them in the night, not during the day, if you're not seeing them on the day during the day. So,
yeah, true, good point.
You know, and it can sometimes be those little baby tiny snails that are doing the damage.
They, you know, they came in on the grapes, apparently.
So, well, the deterrent for that or a bait to use would be rolled oats. Use just small amounts because rolled oats, what happens to them when they get wet? They swell, and snails and slugs can't resist them. They love them, and they gorge themselves
on
the rolled oats. And what happens is that it swells up in their poor little intestines, and they crawl away feeling very unwell, and they pass away. And the bait then doesn't get into the food chain.
No.
You know, so that's another thing. But don't use too many. Only sprinkle enough until they're gone, you know, because otherwise you'll get a rat problem or a bird problem. You know, you won't be feeding the fauna.
And I've been wondering about the clivia question, now that you mention it. I wanted to have seen it similarly in my gardens, wondering whether it's the elephant beetle.
Could be.
Because I see the similar markings on the aeoniums. Like there's a circular patch on, and often on the margin. And I know I've had those, the elephant weevil beetles. So I've often wondered, it'd be interesting to see what other people, whether others have had any thoughts
so
about
again,
it. Similar eating a pattern.
Yeah, so working on the soil is the key to success with that, because if you can raise the internal health of that plant above bricks levels, get them over 12 bricks using a refractometer, insects can't consume that plant material, they'll leave it alone. It's toxic to them, you know. So you lose the aphids at 8 bricks. You lose the sap-sucking insects, things like thrip, white fly.
I have got harlequin bugs,
Harlequin bugs at 9 bricks. At 11 bricks, you lose the cabbage white butterfly, and at 12 bricks, you lose the grasshopper group. So, and that's actually where food's produced. So for those that are testing vegetable plants and they're not getting 12 bricks, you're pretty well raising insect fodder at the moment, which is most of where our supermarket food is at, which is sad.
One of the things I've got quite a lot of evidence of at the moment is leaf cutter bees.
Oh, geez,
I've got quite a few trees that have got that beautiful leaf.
I get them on peaches at home. Yep, they're incredible. And they're so perfect.
Yes, absolutely perfect.
It's incredible. So,
I get them on the Cirsus.
Yeah, I haven't seen them yet. I mean, I've seen them online, but I haven't seen them in my garden. So, yeah, I do keep an eye out, but I have not seen them yet. Blue-banded bees I get lots of.
Yeah, we get heaps of them. Yeah, we get swarms of blue-banded bees.
Gosh, swarms?
Yeah, and we've got quite a few. We've got a very good population of a lot of native bees, native wasps. Because we don't use chemicals at all.
No.
And because we're actually getting like diversity of different sort of plants, like, you know, from grasses to, you know, different size sort of shrubs and everything. So we're actually getting that sort of good coverage for them.
Yeah. Look, it's about, you know, the diversity scenario. I mean, not only the plants, but to have, you know, you've got to create habitat and so forth. I mean, I've gone down the path of burying some terracotta pot sources in the ground in the front. I've always got one in the shade and one in the sun. And I've actually put a small piece of hardwood timber where I've drilled holes through, and I call them a bee boat. And, of course, the timber absorbs the moisture, so it's never hot.
Rosie from Mitcham has come through with a very good suggestion. The plectranthus, known as dog's bane.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Dogs. I totally forgot about that.
Yeah, me too. It's all over the botanic garden.
It is
garden.
A wonderful, pungent smell.
And dogs don't like it.
Mm.
So plectranthus called dog's bane. It's very low ground cover.
It's actually a nice flowering, like it has a beautiful purple or mauve flower.
Yes, it's a perfectly nice plant.
Yeah.
So that would be, that'd be a really good suggestion, I think. And can I also just read the next message? Hello, everyone. Loving the amazing variety of topics today. So good. Other tips on eradicating couch grass, please. I've had black plastic down. P.S. I've heard dogs aren't fond of... aren't fond of lavender or rosemary. So I don't know about that. I've got lavender and rosemary and I haven't noticed any of the dogs staying away from it.
Mm.
But nevertheless, I do think the idea of having plectranthus dog's bane is excellent.
Mm.
Eradicating couch grass.
Manual removal, sadly.
Yeah.
Because if you start cutting that up, you're only propagating more of it. Outcompete it. Yeah, that's the reality. I mean, you've got to outcompete it.
But you've got to manually try and get rid of it first as well. Yeah, so, yeah. And then every time you see it, you need to pull it out.
Yeah, because, correct. Yeah.
Look, and it's the sad thing is it's so easy to go and grab things like glyphosate to just spray thing. But that is so detrimental to the environment and also to our soils, especially the biology.
Within 24 hours of application of any form of glyphosate, you lose 50% of the worm population in your soil.
Well, also that glyphosate is actually, because it's water soluble, it's actually up in our atmosphere. So when it rains, we actually get rained on with like, it's patented as an antibiotic.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And that's the thing, like we've got to try and stay away from things like that because, I mean, if we...
There's no place for it.
There's not. But last year itself, there was 4.4 billion pounds of actually glyphosate sold worldwide. And that's huge.
It's disgraceful. I mean, it's banned in most a lot of other countries, and yet we allow over 20 different types of glyphosate to be used here in Australia.
Well, it's 34 now.
It's incredible.
It's 34.
This is fact of the matter. I mean, if people only knew that, you know, and it's not all wheat and a lot of the grain products are sprayed 2 weeks out from harvest with a glyphosate as a desiccant to dry it out.
Mm.
People would be horrified if they knew that. And I mean, they should look it up.
Well, it is. Not all wheat farmers do it, but there is a lot of wheat farmers do it, though.
There is
still a lot out there that still uses a desiccant. So we are actually getting glyphosate
in
our food as well. I mean, you'd be surprised what it's in.
But to use it around a garden or some place where you're growing food, there's just no place for it, so don't use it.
Yeah.
You know? So manual removal always, you know, and as you have to revisit it, but outcompete it by putting in lots and lots of diversity and plenty of mulch.
And the other thing I found as well is if you actually use 30% vinegar, so it's a cleaning product. So, and you actually just, you only want to lightly spray it. You don't want to put it, you don't want to.
Even dab it on.
Yeah. So you don't want to use huge amounts of it because it will still kill the biology.
Mm.
But if it does get into the atmosphere, it's not as bad as what glyphosate is.
Yeah.
But that's what I was just, you only just want to lightly just spray it and that will actually knock it back even more.
Yeah.
We've had Emma, who was going to be me today.
Right.
I'm covering from Emma because she's very pregnant. And she has said that any of the citronella grasses
also seem to deter
the dogs. They don't like them.
Good call. Yep, absolutely.
You could have a front of lemongrass.
Yes, well, I've actually got lemongrass
that'd
growing
be well
out the front.
Useful,
so, yeah.
Except for the dog wee.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, dear, oh dear. Can I mention that on the 9th of August,
please,
we have our open... Winter Fruit Tree Festival at the Werribee Park Heritage Orchard. It's open from 10 a.m. till 3 p.m. It's a free event. It's become Australia's largest grafting day event. There is no place you can go in Australia that has the amount of different types of rare and heritage plant material available on that day. We have trees available for sale. Obviously, we're volunteers out there, so it's a fundraising day for us. To continue doing the important work we do. We're a heritage listed orchard, so we are preserving the horticultural heritage For Victorians, and it's a wonderful place. We've, you know, so
where's that again?
Werribee Park Heritage Orchard at the Mansion Grounds off Kay Road. If you look up Werribee Park Heritage Orchard, or go to my website, craigcastry.com.au, there's a link to the orchard there. And you look, but look it up. It's a really, really good day. So we have heaps of vendors there on that day, talks, tours, and it's all free.
Excellent. So, yeah. Sounds absolutely wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll miss it because I'll be in
Madeira. Yes, I'm heading overseas, they tell me. Yes.
I'm going to Madeira with Stephen. It'll be very exciting. Yeah. Yes. This has been the 3CR Garden Show. Today you've had me, Virginia Hayward, Ben Brooker from Treasure Perennials, Craig Castry, regenerative edible gardener, Stephen Wells, horticultural therapist and nurse who does wonderful garden beds for the patients at the hospital. So we've had a really interesting day, I think, today. I want to say thank you to everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. It's been great.
And Stephen has been training, which is also...
Yay.
Did a great job too, just quietly.
Appreciate that.
Yes. Well, it's good. It's the more people we can have doing this bit, trying to get all the buttons right.
And I'm guessing we'll look forward to doing it all again another day.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I hope you're all going to tune in next week and we will see you soon. Cheers.
Been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.